Okay, good evening, and welcome to Three Talmudic Heroines, part three and final. And as at this point I assume you are all expert Agadists, I'd like to use this last installment to take things up a notch. In two ways. First of all, tonight we will not be looking at a single stereotype, as we've been doing over the past 2 weeks. Tonight we will be looking at a paradigm, at a general attitude or way of regarding women in Western culture. And two, as opposed to just looking at the Talmudic text, which is what we've been doing up to now, tonight I'd like for us to spend some time looking at commentaries as well. I said in the first class that part of what I'd like for us to try and do is actually get a sense of what it is to work with a piece of Talmud, and working with commentaries is an essential part of that. But let us start with the paradigm. And the paradigm is this. Since the beginning of time, or at least since the beginning of humankind, women have always been divided, dichotomized, forced into two opposite binaries. The good woman and the bad woman. The saintly and the seductive, the maternal and the immoral, the pure and the promiscuous. This general attitude, which has later been known by scholars as the Madonna Hall paradigm, really cuts across the board. Anywhere we look, certainly in the ancient world, we find traces of it. And again, just to give you a brief survey, and I want to go back to pre-biblical literature. The Akkadian Epic of Gilgamesh, for instance. On the one hand, we have the loving, nurturing Ninsun, who is the mother of Gilgamesh. On the other hand, we have the dangerous temptress Ishtar, who tries to destroy him. Think of Jewish mythology. On the one hand, we have Eve, the mother, the first mother. On the other hand, we have Lilith, Adam's disobedient demon wife. Christian tradition. On the one hand, we have, anybody? The Virgin Mary, very good, the paradigmatic Madonna. And on the other hand, Mary Magdalene, the prostitute. Even though it's disputed, she probably wasn't the prostitute, but that was the tradition. Greek literature. Again, the Odyssey. On the one hand, we have Penelope, that faithful wife who waits for years and years for Odysseus to return home. On the other hand, we have Circe, the witch who seduces Odysseus and entraps him in a cave for a year. So throughout the ancient world, whatever the tradition, whatever the culture, whatever the folklore, woman can either be Madonna or whore. There is no middle ground. In fact, this paradigm was so pervasive in the ancient world that it actually exceeds mythology and folklore and becomes an actual practice, an actual split in the household. It was not at all uncommon for women, for men at the time, to have two women at home, one for childbearing and one for sexual gratification. Demosthenes, the famous Greek orator, says, this is number three on your source sheet, "Mistresses we keep for pleasure, and wives to bear us legitimate children and be our housekeepers." Now, we might want to think that this is some sort of antiquated worldview deriving from some sort of patriarchal world order, and that today we are far more enlightened than that. Unfortunately, this is not exactly the case. Over the very many years of the Madonna Hall paradigm, it's been refined. It's become sublimated, but it's never really gone away entirely. And if you think of contemporary popular culture, again, to throw out a handful of examples, I'm sure you could think of others. Think of the Bond movies, the Bond girls, right? On the one hand, we have the loyal sidekicks, Christmas Jones, right? Not a Bond movie myself, but I did do the research. And on the other hand, we have the treacherous murderesses, Electra King. Those of you who've seen the film Black Swan, White Swan and Black Swan, Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis. Or think of who is possibly the most famous Madonna whore pair of the 20th century, Jackie Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe. Look at number 4 on your source sheet. You're a Marilyn or a Jackie. This is actually a poster featured in the hit series Mad Men, where they devise a campaign for lingerie, I believe. And this is the campaign they come up with out of the rationale, and I quote, every single woman is one of them. So thus far, Western culture. Now, what about Jewish culture? And here it becomes a little more complicated. On the one hand, the practice of keeping two women for the fulfillment of one's sexual and procreative needs is strongly condemned. It's not entirely forbidden, but it's strongly condemned by the rabbis as highly immoral and unjust. In fact, when the rabbis want to pinpoint the sin of the generation of Noah, it is this sin that they identify. Look at number 5, and can I ask somebody in one of the front rows to read out loud and clear? Thank you very much.
The men of the generation of the flood used to act thus. Each took 2 wives, one for procreation and the other for sexual gratification. The former would stay like a widow throughout her life, while the latter was given to drink a potion of roots, so that she should not bear, and then she sat before him, made up as a harlot.
Madonna and whore. And this, say the rabbis, this is the sin that destroyed the world. We also have the following interesting anecdote in Ketubot about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Could you read on, please? Second source, number 5.
After the marriage, Rabbi's son departed and spent 12 years at the academy. By the time he returned, his wife had lost the power of procreation. What shall we do, said Rabbi? Should we order him to divorce her? Should we order him to divorce her, it would be said, this poor soul waited in vain. Were he to marry another woman, it would be said, the latter is his wife and the other his mistress. He prayed for mercy to be vouchsafed to her, and she recovered.
Thank you. So Rabbi absolutely refuses to allow his son to take a second wife, because that would demote the first wife from the role of Madonna to the role of whore, and that would be entirely unfair toward her. We also have the interesting following explanation. When does Jacob return to Canaan? Anyone remember? After Joseph was born. Who said that? Very good. And according to one particularly intriguing interpretation, Jacob was very much afraid that if he went back to Canaan and presented his father with 2 wives, one of whom was very beautiful and had no children, and one of whom is very plain and had many children, his father might think that he too married a Madonna and a whore. So Jacob waits until Rachel also gives birth, thereby showing that both of them are legitimate wives, Madonnas. So we see that the rabbis strongly disapprove of the Madonna whore paradigm in practice. In theory, however, the paradigm still dominates Jewish literature, both in the narrative parts, the stories, in which we have many Eve Lilith archetypes, many good women and bad women, the good women being, for instance, the matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. The bad women being some of the femme fatale we discussed last week, Potiphar's wife, Delilah, Jezebel. But also, and no less importantly, in the non-narrative parts, which seem to establish a very clear distinction between the modesty and demureness of a good woman and the brazenness and abandon of her fallen sister. Look at number 6, and when you get sick of reading, let us know, but you're it until then. Thank you. So that's a verse in Deuteronomy. There should be no whore of the daughters of Israel, on which Ramban Nachmanides expounds. Next source.
She who guards herself from abomination and lechery is called holy, kedusha, And she who removes herself from holiness and is defiled with lechery is called a whore, kadesha.
So in Hebrew, the Madonna whore paradigm actually becomes a pun. Kedusha and kadesha. Yes, because we have in the Bible Kedusha wo pio ktiv chasel, which means it's, yes, correct. Go on, please.
It is the manner of the daughters of Israel that they are neither loud voiced nor high paced nor wanton with merrymaking.
So that's a good woman, right? A good woman is shy, modest, and demure, as opposed to the bad woman. Read on, please.
A woman prefers one kav and sexual indulgence to nine kav and continence.
Kav is a measurement. A woman is generally sexually wanton, and this is a bad woman. So for all of their official rejection of the Madonna whore paradigm, Chazal don't seem able to rid themselves of the notion that there are, in fact, two opposite feminine stereotypes. Look at number two.
Charged with the preservation of the family unit and cultural continuity. And by contrast, the sensual, attractive woman who is independent, lascivious, enticing, self-indulgent, and loyal primarily to herself.
Thank you. And it's this pervasive paradigm, this general attitude, which makes the story we're about to read tonight all the more remarkable. That said, let us now look at our story. It's number one. This is our primary text. It appears in Kiddushin 81b. And before we read it, what must we look at? What is... Very good. Somebody's been listening to me. Wow. Thank you. We must look at the context, which is hugely significant in understanding the meaning of the text. In our case, the context is a discussion of Hilchot Yichud, the laws of sequestering yourself with members of the other sex. And after going through the halachic portion, the laws, we have a story cycle. We've mentioned a few times that stories in the Talmud will often come in groups. A cycle which describes all manner of sexual transgression, adultery, and seduction. And after this very long and really very disturbing cycle, at the very end, we have our story. So that is the context. And again, as we've been doing in previous weeks, what I'd like to do is read the story through once, see what it means at face value, and then go back, look at it more closely, and try and unpack the more complex message hidden between the lines. Would you mind reading for us? Thank you. Thank you. Just to interject with some comments. Whenever he prostrated himself, this is nefilat apayim. This is that portion of the davening when you go into freestyle, when you really say what is in your hearts of hearts, when you ask God for whatever is most pressing. And what Rav Chiya Bar Ashi asks for is to be saved from the evil inclination. Evil inclination, yetzer hara, in the Talmud means the sexual drive. Go on, please.
Him repeatedly. He said to her, "Who are you?" She said, "I am Chiruta, and I just returned today."
Just, I will point out that at this point, Rashi says Chiruta was the name of a famous courtesan in the town, a prostitute.
He demanded her services. She said to him, "Bring me that pomegranate at the end of that branch." He jumped up, went, and brought it to her. When he came home, his wife was firing the oven. He rose up and sat in it.
And again, a clarification. Sitting in the oven, it's not a way to warm your feet. This is actually attempted suicide.
She said to him, "What is this? said, thus and so happened. She said, it was me. He paid no attention to her until she gave him the signs. He said to her, nevertheless, my intention was to violate a prohibition. That righteous man fasted until he died of that death.
Thank you. Lovely reading. Very good. Okay, so I said that I'd like to take it up a notch and look at some of the interpretations, some of the scholarship surrounding the story. Now, this is actually a very good story to work with because it is incredibly popular with contemporary Agadists. In fact, I don't think there was one self-respecting Agadist over the previous decade who hasn't felt the need to write something about this text. There is a lot written about it, and as you are all at this point, again, you are Agadist scholars, and as I hope by now you have a bit of a sense of what makes for a valid interpretation, what I'd like to do is present to you some of the readings offered for this story, and I'd like for you to tell me whether you think they work, whether they are, in fact, valid. And what makes this easy is that we can generally categorize all the many interpretations given to this story into three basic schools. The first school, it belongs to the classical commentaries, mainly Rashi and Maharsha. Those are the two commentators who write the most about Agadah. Maharsha. Mem he resh shin aleph. Maharsha. And they say the following. Look at number 7.
He has separated himself from me because of old age.
So Rashi, and then Maharsha, who really follows this interpretation, see this as a story of an elderly couple. Rav Chiya and his wife, but primarily Rav Chiya, are beyond their sexual prime. They are no longer sexually active. And what happens in our story is some sort of way of regaining lost youth and vitality. Now, what do we think of this interpretation? You're already shaking your head. Yes? Okay, you can't just shake your head. You have to explain. How? Yeah. Are you asking or are you saying? You're saying that they were physically okay.
I don't know.
Ah, what do you think? Yes.
I think clearly they are not past their sexual prime because she doesn't seem to be so happy that he has separated himself from her, and he certainly isn't past his sexual prime because when she dresses up and says she's Chevruta, he immediately demands her services.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, yes.
Plus the fact that she can convincingly dress herself up as a famous courtesan would suggest that she's in somewhat of a sexual prime.
Good. Yes.
The text says that he is constantly denying the, what we call the animal nature.
Mm-hmm. Which means it's probably still alive in him. All correct. First of all, we have an encounter in the story. The two actually do come together, which means they can't be past their sexual prime. Two, Rav Chiya's wife, but certainly Rav Chiya, the sexual urge is still very much alive and well within him. And three, I would like to point out that at some point he climbs a tree. So this is not a man of 95. He jumped up. So there's some sprightliness there. So, with respect, yes?
There are various places in the Talmud that talk about men who abstained from their wives for reasons implying that they were trying to be more holy. It's interesting why Rashi should see this as being different from all the other.
Could you give me an example of another such narrative? Because the only other stories I know of men abstaining from their wives are rabbis who go away to study. That is a very famous alternative, but that, and we'll go into the halachic ramifications in a little bit, that's the situation in which that is okay. Right, right. Many others, absolutely. Okay, I want to let's respectfully bracket this interpretation with respect to Rashi and Maharsha, who were great, and move on to the second school. Now, the second school takes very seriously the rule that we must read halachic narrative, agadic narrative in context. And so it zooms out. We said the story comes as part of a cycle of seduction narratives, and it looks at some of the seduction narratives that come before our story. We have very many of them. I brought two, and they're in number 8. Would you read them for us, please?
Rabbi Meir used to scoff at transgressors. One day, Satan appeared to him in the guise of a woman on the opposite bank of the river. As there was no ferry, he seized the rope and proceeded across. When he had reached halfway along the rope, he, Satan, let him go, saying, "Had they not proclaimed in heaven, 'Take heed of Rabbi Meir and his learning,' I would have valued your life at 2 ma'as.
2 ma'as. Ma'as is a very paltry coin.
Rabbi Akiva used to scoff at transgressors. One day, Satan appeared to him as a woman on the top of a palm tree. Grasping the tree, he went climbing up. But when he reached halfway up the tree, he, Satan, let him go, saying, "Had they not proclaimed in heaven, 'Take heed of Rabbi Akiva and his learning,' I would have valued your life at 2 ma'as.
So these are two, and we have a few more of these. And so critics look at these seduction narratives and they say, well, actually, our story is quite similar. We have a seduction of a great rabbi. We have a climbing motif. There are certain other similarities. And so they say, essentially, what our story is another seduction narrative. It's a story of the ensnaring and undoing of a great man by a diabolical femme fatale, who in this case just happens to be his wife, not Satan. Look at number 9.
The devil takes the shape of Rabbi Chiya Bar Ashi's wife, manipulating him into a situation from which there is no way out other than death. The narrative demonstrates that man cannot free himself from the firm grip of the evil inclination.
Thank you. All right, you're the scholars. What do you think? You agree? And you're still shaking your head. No? Can you explain, or it's just a gut feeling? Ah, you're hitting on a very important point, in fact, a crucial point, which I'm going to ask you to hold on to because we're going to go there. We're going to go exactly there. But I'd still like to ask, do we find this reading convincing? Oh, we'll get there. We will be talking about that quite a bit later. Yes. Are you talking about our story or the stories that come before it?
I'm talking about
all both.
That come before it and Shulamit Valor, the source of that story.
Right.
So
you're
suggesting that any time the woman is being seductive, it's
right, 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 right. That is indeed the argument. And again, I'd like to ask, you know, whether or not we like it, do we think it's valid? And maybe I'll make the question a little more pointed. The critics who say this story is like the other stories are looking at the similarities. But can we are the stories really that similar? Or can we discern any differences between them? Yes?
I feel like it's trying to stay away from calling her the whore by saying he doesn't want to make his wife the whore because she's the Madonna right now. But because
okay, I really feel like I have to cut you off because you're like preempting everything I'm going to say later. So please stop. Yes. Ah, very good. Okay, so first of all, in our story, and this is not insignificant, we have got a devil, we've got a flesh and blood woman. Let me ask you this. What happens at the end of the preceding stories? There's almost a seduction and then? there's a narrow escape. What happens in our story? There is no narrow escape. There is a seduction. In addition, our story, and this is not at all trivial, is longer. It's infinitely richer in detail. And that might already point to the fact that our story is a little more complex. Last week, somebody asked me why I felt the need to read the story we were dealing with then in a way that was very different from the stories that came after it. And we do often have this, where in a story cycle, we'll have a few short stories setting up a certain pattern, and then one longer story that breaks the pattern. This is what happens here. We also have no narrow escape. Let me ask you something else. The preceding stories in number 8, who is at the center of them? Who's the main character? The devil, do you think? The rabbis, the seduced man. Who's at the center of our story? The seducing woman. She's actually very much at the center of the story. We follow the story through her point of view. Throughout the story, we know what she knows. We hear what she hears. We think what she thinks. If the story were told from Lafria's point of view, it would have been a very different story, because Lafria doesn't know that his wife overhears him, and Lafria doesn't know that she's actually the prostitute. So we're actually following the story through the eyes of the woman, which makes her, in literary terms, the true heroine of the story. So I'm going to claim that this interpretation is inadequate, because far more than similarities, we actually have many differences between the narratives. And again, we will respectfully bracket it and move on to the third. And the third school of interpretation gets really interesting. What the critics do, these are all contemporary critics, and this is actually the most popular of interpretations, they actually make an attempt at what I've called revisioning, at rereading the story from a redemptive point of view to try and show that the woman is not the femme fatale that she is accused of being, that she seems to be at first reading. Now, the person who takes the lead on this interpretation is local scholar Shlomo Ne'eh. He writes a very, very important essay about Cheruta, which then is picked up by every single Agadist who follows, and everybody quotes him, and this is very much the dominant reading today. But before I give you the bottom line of the reading, a little bit of background. The Talmud, we know, was compiled during the ascent of Christianity, first as a sect within Judaism and then as an independent religion outside of Judaism. Now, Christianity becomes increasingly successful, and the rabbis at some point feel they have to stand their ground and they have to mark their boundaries against this new rival religion. And so what you get in the Talmud, every now and again, are these veiled attacks against certain Christian beliefs or practices. Often they're subtext. Often you actually have to look for them. They don't come out immediately. They have to be found. They're between the lines. But if you do read the Talmud with such an eye, certain things will pop out at you that you might have not seen before. Example. Many of you I know, I'm sure, are familiar with the famous Mishnah in Tractate Rosh Hashanah, V'chi Adav Shel Moshe Osot Milchama. Very famous Mishnah alluding to the biblical story of the war between the Israelites and the Amalekites in the desert. And we know that Moshe stood on a hill, and when he raised his hands, the Israelites would win. And when he lowered his hands, the Israelites would lose. Nod your head if you know what I'm talking about. Okay, good. And the rabbis say, V'chi adav shel Moshe osot milchama. Can it be that the hands of Moses determined the outcome of the war? No, it was when he raised his hands, the Israelites would think of their father in heaven and would win. And when he lowered his hands, the Israelites would forget their father in heaven and would lose. Now, this seems to be just a nice little vault about the importance of prayer. But think about it this way. You have the figure of Moshe, of Moses, standing on a hill, erect. His arms are raised, but they're not raised like this. They're raised like this. Can't do it because of the microphone. That. The cross. And the rabbis don't want anybody thinking that this has any intrinsic power in it. This is actually a veiled polemic against the cross. Indeed. We don't know from the Bible how he raised his hands. We're just told that he raised his hands. Who's to say that he raised them like this? Maybe he actually, possibly, but maybe it's this. And maybe this is what urges the rabbis to say, no, it was not the hands of Moses at all. Now, our story is told, depicts the 4th century, a small town outside of Sura. Now, the Syriac Jewish communities of the time were very much influenced by their Christian neighbors. Christianity was becoming popular, and certain Christian values were making inroads into the Jewish community. Specifically, says Shlomo Ne'eh, abstinence was becoming very popular to the point that certain Jews were adopting it as a value. And so, says Shlomo Ne'eh, the rabbis tell this story as a cautionary tale. If you will try and be like those Christians, if you will try and abstain from sexual relations with your wife, you will end up, like Rav Chia, sinning with a prostitute. Take heed. Now, I will just say that this reading, too, like the previous one, is informed by certain parallel narratives that we have both in Bible and in rabbinic literature of a woman who is deprived of sexual relations, whose man abstains from her, who then seduces that man in disguise. Can anybody think of Tamar? Exactly right. Tamar is actually very similar to our own story, so much so that scholars will claim that our story is told in a way more or less based on that biblical narrative, and that's in number 11. We also have the following interesting midrash in number 12. Could you read it for us?
Wife to him, "From your bread you have eaten, and from your cup you have drunk, but you are rude of manner."
We also have a very similar midrash in a much later work called Yalkut HaMechiri about the conception of David, which tells very similarly that David's father Jesse separates himself from his wife because he didn't really love her, makes a rendezvous with another woman. The other woman tells Jesse's wife. Jesse's wife goes and takes her place at the rendezvous, and so was David conceived. Now, according to this reading, the background to our story is actually Rav Chia's deliberate decision to abstain from sexual relations with his wife. Look at number 10. Oh, no, in general, to abstain, to adopt the Christian value of abstinence.
Except that he was able to be seduced.
Ah, well, we will get there.
Okay.
Ten.
The Syriac Christian idea of a war for freedom from the sexual impulse captivated members of the Babylonian Jewish community. The story is a negative portrayal of the ascetic ideal, or at least its presentation as irremediably at odds with the common Jewish ideal of family life.
So that's the third interpretation. It really is the prevailing reading today, and I'd like to ask you again what you think of it. I will grant you that it's very good, very compelling. Yes? So I think we have to qualify what we mean when we say they. I don't think it's true of all the people at the time. It was certainly true of certain mainly Greek cultures. It was a common practice elsewhere too. But are you inferring from that anything about this particular reading?
Well, I don't know.
Are you saying that, you know, by extension, we can assume that Rav Chia abstains from his wife and then has relations with either men or... Well, I'm glad you brought up the word psychologically, because that's actually exactly where we're going to go in a little bit. Yes. Right. And a lot of scholars, again, who have done a lot of work on, you know, sex in the Talmud, and because it's like popular today, really love this thrust of rabbinic thought, saying, you know, sex is an inherent part of healthy human life, and we embrace it and we celebrate it. And I think that's part of why this reading has become very popular. But again, I want to ask you, because in spite of how we might like to adopt this reading, I have a very basic problem with it. I think there's a gaping hole in it, and it's been raised before. Yes?
We would have had a happy ending. If that were the goal of the story, it would have been more clear, I think, which, like, the point would have been a little more strongly brought out in order to...
Well, I think, first of all, the Talmud doesn't always make things easy for us. It doesn't always articulate the take-home message. And secondly, actually, the point of a cautionary tale is that it ends in tragedy. That's why it's a cautionary tale. It's if you do this, this is how you're going to end up. So I think that's consistent with the ending of the story. Yes, would you repeat what you said before, please? Because you nailed it. You know, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
I was going to ask Nelk. I mean, his problem is that he is abstaining from his wife, but maybe abstaining completely. But isn't there anything? I mean, it's okay to go out to prostitute.
No. He's actually abstaining completely. Yatzileni rachaman miyetzer amedi. Lord, save me from the evil inclination. He's abstaining. That's later. We haven't gotten there yet. We haven't gotten there yet. Okay, we're running out of time, so I'm just going to repeat what you said beforehand for you, because I think that's actually exactly my problem with this reading. We have chovat ona in Jewish law. According to Jewish law, there is a conjugal obligation of a husband toward his wife. A husband must be with his wife sexually at certain regular intervals, depending on his profession. And I find it somewhat bothersome that a man as great as Rav Chia Bar Ashi, who according to some historians was actually a head of the yeshiva, elected to simply ignore this very basic command. Moreover, why does the wife not address this blatant violation of her conjugal right, particularly once she learns of her husband's struggle to persist in it? And perhaps most importantly, if Rav Chia really does make a conscious decision to abstain from sexual relation, and he wages this holy war against the evil inclination, how is it that he falls so immediately at the sight of a prostitute without so much as a hint of resistance? Yes, very quickly. I'm going to stop you, because you're going to steal everything I have to say, and then I have nothing else to say. But yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right. So it's a good reading. I think there are certain holes in it, and I say this with great modesty because it's been put forward by very many great scholars, and needs a bit of fine-tuning, and this is what I'd like to do with you tonight. And my claim will be, I've got to stop with the discussion now and move on, I'm sorry. And my claim is this. It's not, as some of you have already pointed out, it is not aversion to sexual relations in general that plagues Rav Chia. It is sexual relations specifically with his wife, the Madonna. But I want to stop now and go back to the beginning. Let's go back to the story and start again. Now, our story, like very many Talmudic narratives, is composed of three acts. Act 1, in lines 1 and 2, which I'm going to call Revelation. Act 2, in lines 3 to 9, which I will call seduction. And Act 3, in lines 10 to 17, which I will call confrontation. Now, Act 1 begins, again, like many other Talmudic narratives, with a routine that is about to be broken. It's not at all rare for a Talmudic story to start with, this is what would always happen, and then one day something else happened. So what is the routine described, or what is the routine we might infer from lines 1 and 2? Right.
And that his wife heard him. That's
the breaking of the routine. Okay. But the routine is Rav Chia was waging war against his sexual inclination and that he basically had separated himself from his wife for very many years. And again, most scholars see this as a result of a conscious choice. And again, we found this explanation lacking. And to try and understand what is behind this, I'd like to turn to Sigmund Freud. We don't have to agree with everything Freud says. I know I don't, but he has certain insights which are invaluable. And one such insight is this. Stop reading Freud. Let me explain. Says Freud, when you encounter cross-cultural phenomena, when you see certain beliefs or certain practices which happen in very many different cultures that don't necessarily come into contact with one another, you may safely assume that the root of that phenomenon, that belief or practice, is not sociological, but psychological, that it's rooted within the human psyche. And so Freud looks around and sees that all of these cultures have a way of dichotomizing women into two groups. And he takes the Madonna whore paradigm and uses it to develop the Madonna whore complex. What is the Madonna whore complex? For Freud, the Madonna whore complex plagues men. It's an interesting question to consider whether there is a parallel complex for women, but Freud speaks about men. Men who fail to develop a healthy, mature attitude towards sex. And this is how he describes it. And now we can turn to Freud, number 13, and I do apologize for some of the risque language. Would you mind terribly reading it for us? Thank you.
The whole sphere of love remains divided in the two directions personified in art as sacred and profane or animal love. Where they love, they do not desire, and where they desire, they cannot love. If someone makes an impression that might lead to a highly psychical estimation of her, this impression does not find an issue in any sensual excitation, but in affection which has no erotic effect. This psychical impotence, this psychical impotence manifests itself in a refusal by the executive organs of sexuality to carry out the sexual act, although before and after they may show themselves to be intact and capable of performing the act.
Thank you. So for Freud, the Madonna whore complex is a form of a psychical split between good women, who are the object of love, and bad women, who are the object of desire. And no woman can be both, right? He says, where they love, they do not desire, and where they desire, they cannot love. If a man suffering from this complex meets a woman whom he grows to love or respect, she will inevitably remind him of his mother. He will not be able to regard her erotically. He will not be able to desire her, and ultimately, he will not be able to perform with her sexually. So it's a form, says Freud, of psychical impotence. Now, if Avchia Bar Ashi does indeed consider sex to be sinful or depraved, and I think from his prayer we might assume that he does, it is not at all inconceivable that he should develop such a complex, placing his wife, an object of sacred love, far beyond the realm of the sensual, divested of all erotic desire. Now, his sexual drive may remain potent and dangerously so, but his wife can no longer arouse it. It's not that Rav Chaya Bar Ashi refuses, according to this reading, to carry out his marital duties. He just can't. Now, what do men do when faced with a Madonna whore complex? According to Freud, men suffering from this complex will often find an outlet in the form of what he calls a debased sexual object. And this is the final paragraph of number 13. Could you please read it for us?
Man is assured of complete sexual pleasure only when he can devote himself unreservedly to obtaining satisfaction, which with his well-brought-up wife, for instance, he does not dare to do. This is the source of his need for a debased sexual object, a woman who is ethically inferior, to whom he need attribute no aesthetic scruples, who does not know him as his other social relations, and cannot judge him in them. It is to such a woman that he prefers to devote his sexual potency, even when the whole of his affection belongs to a woman of a higher kind.
Thank you. So the violent struggle betrayed by Rav Chia's prayer is not against lust for his own wife, as many critics have claimed. Quite the contrary. His wife, saintly and pure and safely asexual, is absolutely no threat. It's against the women beneath her, those low, licentious women who might burst the dam of his raging desire, which, as we'll see, is exactly what happens. What about the wife? How does she regard her husband's many years celibacy? How does she respond to her husband's unwitting revelation? And then what's the emotion she betrays? Before betrayal, when she says, for many years he's separated himself of me, why does he say this? What kind of emotion are we getting here? Confusion? Anger? Say something a lot more basic. Surprise! Why did he say this? Evidently, she had believed her husband to be a man far beyond the throes of physical passion. Some holy man who fought his evil inclination and won. As such, she might have agreed to waive her conjugal rights, and halachically a woman can waive her conjugal rights, yielding to what she believed to be her husband's wishes. Look at number 14.
She was no doubt uncomfortable with the situation, but submitted, understanding, possibly also admiring the man angel with whom she lived.
Thank you. Yes. Explain, please.
The idea of putting sexual desire in a different category.
Certainly. Certainly. No, no, no.
Very positive.
No question, which is why... No, no, no. We have to, when we look at a Talmudic narrative, we must make the separation between the characters inside the story and the people telling the story. Okay, the people telling the story are on your side, very much so. But there is a character inside the story who, whether he's taken in by some sort of ideal of abstinence or whether he has some deeper psychological problem, seems to somehow erroneously view sex as negative. Okay? But I really would like to move on because I don't want to keep you here any more than I absolutely must. I'm missing a page of my notes. All right, command it to memory. Ah, there it is. So herein lies the full tragedy of the Barashi's marital life. A husband and wife, both contending with unfulfilled sexual desire, both believing themselves to be alone in their struggle. For what makes their situation all the more pitiable is their apparent inability to talk about it. Throughout this entire first act, and admittedly it's short, but throughout this entire first act, Rav Chia and his wife engage in no dialogue at all. Neither seems able to tell the other what they're feeling. Rav Chia prefers to confess his yearnings in prayer, afraid perhaps that such an admission made to his chaste, Madonna-like wife would sink him in her estimation. And the wife, for her part, cannot bring herself to tell her man-angel husband of her yearning for fear of incurring his contempt. So it's not just sexual relations that Avchia and his wife abstain from. It is all relations. Until this routine is one day broken. Overhearing her husband's anguished plea, the wife realizes how wide the gulf between them has become. How her own secret desire is mirrored by his. How he is no more a man angel than she is a Madonna. What doesn't she do at this point? Talk to him. Bring it up one evening. Possibly, because if she did, we would have no story. This is actually a valid point. Or, possibly, that at this point she understands that her husband is so consumed by the Madonna whore complex that talking to him at this stage would be completely futile. Her husband will not touch her as long as she remains a Madonna in his eyes. To bring down the barrier between them, she must become a whore instead. Act 2, seduction. Now, Act 2 begins with another more radical break in the routine. One day, Rav Chia was studying in his garden. The action is transported from the civility and decorum of the home to the garden in all of its wildness and disorder. Now, gardens in the time of the Talmud were not the backyard. They were actually on the outskirts of town. And the choice of a garden as a place of study is highly irregular. The only other times in the Talmud we have rabbis studying in gardens is when they're actually discussing certain laws of agriculture. Rav Chia is sitting in his garden. This is unusual. So the lush surroundings, and ultimately the feminine seduction and the plucking of the fruit bear ominous connotations to what? Garden of Eden, very good. Rav Chia's controlled celibate world is about to descend into sin. And just as the scenery changes, so is our heroine transformed. From a compliant, self-sacrificing housewife, she becomes, in the words of Nitzer Barbanel, an independent, lascivious femme fatale who is loyal primarily to herself. Like those wanton women in the generation of Noah, she paints herself up as a harlot, makes herself up as a harlot. The Aramaic term, actually, is kishta. Kishta in the Talmud generally refers to female preparation for and solicitation of sex. Seeking, in her painted disguise, to lure her husband into releasing his own pent-up sexual energy and at the same time to satisfy her own needs. Now, this is not, as some critics have claimed, a test of fidelity, seeing whether he will succumb to the charms of another woman. As evidenced by the fact that when he confesses to it later in Act 3, she is not at all upset. This is a desperate attempt of a lonely wife to regain lost intimacy with her husband. That's what? Very, very good. Yes, absolutely. Let's look at number 16. Yes. Yes, and Nachon.
After discovering that Rav Chiya had not eliminated his evil inclination, she assumes his abstinence is not the result of religious conviction, but rather of a mental or emotional problem. She decides, therefore, to take matters into her own hands and come to the help of her tormented husband.
Thank you. And indeed, no sooner does Rav Chiya observe this debased sexual object that he demands her identity. And I completely agree. The fact that he fails to recognize his own wife attests to the degree of alienation between them. The wife responds, assuming the name Cheruta, which again, according to Rashi, is the name of a famous local courtesan. Now, these two lines, go back to the story. Lines 5 and 6 serve no plot-related purpose whatsoever. If the story would have gone like this, number 4, his wife made herself up and passed before him repeatedly. Number 7, he demanded her services. The story would have been a lot more quick, a lot more taut, a lot more dramatic. There's something here slowing down the action. However, and this is another important rule of thumb when studying Agadah, or Talmud in general. Talmud, as we all know, began as an oral text. And because it had to be memorized, it became incredibly condensed and compact. So much so that if something is there, if something has made it in, you have to ask yourself why it made it in. And if those two sentences made it into an otherwise very short, very packed story, you have to ask yourself what these sentences are doing, because they don't seem to be advancing the plot. Yes?
Is it maybe a form of role
play? So it has been suggested, I've given this class before, and it has been suggested that this might be some sort of elaborate type of role play. It's interesting to read it that way. I don't think it works with the plot as we read it, because, you know, it ends in suicide. So clearly there's more than a game going on. So what are these two lines doing here? Yes? Very good. We will get there. But for first thing, all good. But I'd like to point out, before any of this, this is a dialogue. It's the first dialogue we have in the story. Those cravings so secret, those secret cravings so carefully concealed in Act One are now openly announced. Oscar Wilde says, this is number 17 on your source sheet, give a man a mask and he will tell you the truth. We're coming close to Purim. This is the paradox of disguise. Sometimes you conceal to reveal. You don a disguise because paradoxically it's behind the disguise that you can tell the truth. And Cheruta, the wife hiding behind the mask of a prostitute can flagrantly announce her sexuality, while Rav Chiya, who is now faced with a woman, and I quote Freud, who does not know him in his other sexual relations and cannot, in his other social relations and cannot judge him in them, freely solicits her services. Moreover, the wife's assertion, I am Cheruta and I have just returned today, signifies far more than her promiscuous dress or her provocative manner, a radical change, a metamorphosis from a nameless, selfless wife of to a named, independent, autonomous subject. The former Madonna has now returned, as she said. She's changed. She's come into her own. She's developed an identity unhinged from the identity of her husband. We spoke in the first class how most women appear in the Talmud as wives of, mothers of, sisters of, daughters of. Chiruta here goes from a wife of to somebody with her name. Names in number 18 on your source sheet are a symbolic and literal act of mastery, naming. And in naming herself, the wife exhibits all of the agency and self-determination acquired in her new role as whore. But most importantly is the name the wife chooses. So we said Chiruta, well, first of all, Chiruta is a nonce word. It appears nowhere else in the Talmud. And the rabbis, actually the rabbis, scholars, commentators, everybody has a real field day trying to understand what it means. Rashi says it's a name of a famous courtesan in the town. Many scholars have said, well, Chiruta from the root Chirut, liberty. But the name has also been interpreted to mean, let's see if I can do this, a wedding party, a reveler, a withered branch, I think that's it, and a released prisoner. However, the most rigorous analysis of the name belongs again to Shlomo Na'eh, who is a great philologist. And what Shlomo Na'eh does, as we have this name nowhere else in the Talmud, he actually traces uses of this word in contemporaneous Syriac texts. He goes to texts from the same era and geographical region, and he sees how Chiruta is used there, and he comes to the following fascinating conclusion. Look at number 19.
The word is remarkable for its Jonas-like duality of meaning. On the one hand, it reflects the life of self-control and suppression of impulse, the celibacy and dignity that are the obligation of the social class of free persons. On the other hand, it expresses the enticements of the sort of freedom that entails unrestrained behavior, debauchery, and licentiousness.
Thank you. So Chiruta, says Shlomo Na'eh, is actually a pun. It's a wordplay based on the double meaning of liberty. And by adopting this name, the wife, in essence, is proclaiming her ability to practice both sexual freedom as a wanton harlot and freedom from sexuality as a freeborn noblewoman. The very choice of the name Chiruta breaks down the dichotomy between Madonna and whore. It means both. It is in this case a microcosm of the entire story, but we'll get to that in a little bit. However, all of these subtleties are completely lost upon Rav Chiya, who, unable to fight his evil inclination anymore, abandons the Torah he's been studying and solicits her services. The word used, actually, in the Aramaic is tva'ah. Tva'ah in the Talmud generally refers to coarse or alienated sexual relations, which we know, according to Freud, is precisely symptomatic of men suffering from the Madonna whore complex. Look at number 20.
Men do not usually show much refinement in their modes of behavior and love. They have retained perverse sexual aims.
This is not all men. This is men suffering from the Madonna whore complex.
They have retained perverse sexual aims whose non-fulfillment is felt as a serious loss of pleasure, and whose fulfillment, on the other hand, seems possible only with a debased and despised sexual object.
Thank you. But our heroine is no longer a compliant wife. Before yielding to Rav Chiya's demand, she demands that he get her a pomegranate from the uppermost bough of the tree. If she is to cure her husband of his complex, she must be able to prove her identity to him after the deed is done. And Rav Chiya, his desire aflame, scrambles up the tree, plucks the fruit. I will say incidentally, that many seduction narratives in the Talmud feature the motif of climbing, and I leave it to you to draw your own phallic conclusions from that. And the narrator modestly draws the curtain on the scene. The seduction, we can only infer, has succeeded. Act 3, confrontation. With the opening of Act 3, the action has once again shifted back indoors into the order and civility of the home. And our heroine, accordingly, has slipped back into her role of devoted housewife. As the curtain once again rises, we find her, what? Cooking, making dinner, engaged in the most wifely of chores. She has gone from Madonna to whore to Madonna, from kindling her husband's lust to kindling the kitchen fire with complete effortlessness. Dignified and sensual, amorous and modest, proper and passionate. All feminine binaries seem to dissolve in her person. She is both Madonna and whore. If anything, it's the man for whom the Madonna whore paradigm holds true. It's Rav Chiya who seems incapable of integrating decorum and desire. The events of the past few hours, which have left his wife completely unfazed, have traumatized him to the point of suicide. He comes home, sees his chaste wife standing by the oven, and overcome with guilt and shame, throws himself into it. I don't know why you're laughing. This is a tragedy. This is not funny. Now, possibly from the sense of shock, and possibly from her newfound courage that she acquired in her role as whore, the wife breaks her many years of silence and turns to her husband in question. What is this? And thus is the barrier of communication shattered. As opposed to the double monologues of Act 1 and the masked dialogue of Act 2, Rav Chiya and his wife now communicate directly. And Rav Chiya, kind of like we saw Rava last week, is unable to keep the truth from his wife. And he tells her, thus and so happened. Afraid that now that she learns the truth about him, she will despise him forever. And yet, rather than pain or anger or derision, his confession is met of one of her own. It was me. The prostitute in the garden, that debased sexual object, was none other than her. And Rav Chiya? He doesn't believe her. He is clinging so fiercely to his Madonna-like conception of her, he seems to be incapable of believing. He refuses to believe her capable of such promiscuous conduct. And what does she do? She knew what was going to happen. She really planned this out. She was very prepared for her husband's disbelief, and she immediately produces the signs, which probably means that pomegranate that she demanded as pay. If she could only get her husband to see her for what she really is, a Madonna and a whore, a good woman and a sexual woman, an object of love and desire, perhaps she could extricate him from the throes of the Madonna whore complex. But to no avail. What should have brought him inexplicable relief, the knowledge that his sin wasn't that grave after all. It's still a sin, incidentally. If you have relations with one person thinking it's another person, that's still a sin, but it's not as bad as adultery. And yet, what should have come as inexplicable relief only serves to traumatize Rav Chiya even more, to devastate him even more. Nevertheless, my intention was to violate a prohibition, he says stonily, and turns away from her, perhaps in anger, perhaps in contempt. Whether he can't forgive himself for succumbing to his evil inclination, or whether he can't forgive her for failing to be the saint he had idolized, or both, is unclear. What is clear, however, and tragically so, is that the wife's plan has miscarried. Her husband's complex is still firmly anchored in his mind, and within it she must remain, either a deified and untouched Madonna, or a despised and untouched whore, or a widow. For unable to live with his burning sense of shame, Rav Chia fasts until he dies of that death. Officially, we have to finish in 5 minutes. I can go on. I'm going to take an extra 2 minutes just to comment on the phrase "that righteous man," because some people find this troubling. If Rav Chia really is so tragically wrong, then why does the text call him Otot Tzadik? So, three possible answers. Possibly, all three of them are correct. One. Jona Frenkel and other scholars have shown that this is actually a later addition to the story, that the original story doesn't have this line, and that this line was inserted after the fact to make the story a little more kosher. Two, the phrase, the final line, but actually number lines 15 and 17 are both a later addition to the story.
The suicide.
Sorry? Not the suicide. The suicide. Yes. But the fact that he's called a tzaddik might be a later addition come to actually make the story more okay than it is. Two, tzaddik is sometimes actually used in an ironic sense, both in the Talmud and in the Bible. The primary example is Yosef HaTzaddik, who is called Yosef HaTzaddik despite his complex relation to sexual matters. And three, we spoke about the story of Judah and Tamar. Our story is very much seen as based on the two biblical texts of the Garden of Eden and Judah and Tamar, and specifically the latter, to which it is strikingly similar. Some of the similarities that come up? The signs, good. What else?
The disguise,
very good. Ah, tzedka mimeni. She is more righteous than I. So we have a woman depraved of her of sexual relations. We have disguise as a prostitute. We have a seduction. We have a demanding of signs. We have, incidentally, the punishment of death by fire. And we have that final note of Tzedka Mimeni. So we have two almost identical stories, except completely opposite endings. One ends in birth, the birth of who ultimately becomes the forefather of David, his brother, and one ends in death. And one explanation as to why is that while Judah was able to say she is more righteous than I, Rav Chia remains staunchly that righteous man. If he were able, like Judah, to see that she is the more righteous, perhaps there might have been some sort of reconciliation here. Now we've seen how in portraying the tragic consequences of the Madonna whore complex, in showing us a woman who is effectively able to exercise both sexual restraint and sexual freedom, and in featuring a name that means both these things, the story systematically undermines the Madonna whore paradigm. But there's one final aspect I'd like to quickly consider, and that is how the story in its actual structure deconstructs the feminine dichotomy. Now, we said the story is in three acts. And I'd like to claim that these acts basically form a thesis, antithesis, synthesis triad. Act one, the thesis, features the Madonna. Act two, the antithesis, centers on the whore. And Act 3 effectively fuses the two. For though in Act 3 we are once again back in the home and the wife is once more a compliant housewife, there are nevertheless a number of whorish elements that punctuate the scene. We have the oven, both menacing and mundane, used to both make food and kill, a befitting symbol of female sexuality. We have the wife's assertion, what is this, the first time she speaks out with confidence. We have her avowal, it was me, Ana Havai, which echoes Ana Cheruta, I am Cheruta in the previous act. And we have the pomegranate, which according to Cosman in number 22, is a symbol of lust or fertility. Lust or fertility, whore or Madonna. So all these serve to conflate the two previous acts, blurring the boundaries between home and garden, order and chaos, propriety and passion. The narrative itself, like its heroine, brings down the dichotomy between, brings down the feminine dichotomy. Madonna and whore become one. Two quick observations and I will end, I promise. One, some people walked out of here last week quite upset, for which I apologize, that was not my intention. But we dealt with some difficult subject matter last week, some themes that people might find very jarring, very upsetting, very antithetical to our 21st century progressive sensibilities. And what I've tried to show throughout this series is that though there we can find that in the Talmud, we can find that misogynism there, there is also the possibility of an alternative reading, of a redemptive reading, of a reading that actually shows these stories to be a lot closer to our enlightened sensibilities than they initially seem. This story specifically, I think, it's remarkable that a text that originates in a world so steeped in the Madonna whore paradigm, in a world that really couldn't see women any other way, a story able to lift its head up above that and say, hold on, this is wrong. This doesn't work. It's not right and it's not fair. And I don't know about you, but the fact that this story belongs in our Talmud makes me personally very proud of our tradition. And two, I said in the first class that when the Talmud tells a story of a woman, more often than not, it is telling a story of an other with a capital O. And that through these female texts, we might glean a more general ethical message about how to treat the others in our lives. And so what this story is doing is not just attacking the Madonna whore paradigm, it's actually attacking the reduction of anyone to a stereotype, to a singular role, to a specific function that he or she plays for me. That says the Talmud is not only wrong, because no one is that one-dimensional, and no one was put on this earth just to serve you. It's also highly immoral. It's dangerous. It will end in death. Now this danger of reducing somebody else to a role actually becomes the heart of the ethical philosophy of Immanuel Kant, arguably the most important of ethical philosophers, who says the following in number 23. This is his categorical imperative. Act in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of any other, never merely as a means to an end, but always at the same time as an end. Never treat somebody as a means to an end, always as an end to himself. 20th century, important Jewish philosopher Martin Buber comes along and expresses a very similar sentiment in his monumental work, I and Thou. Could you read number 24 for us, please?
Intervene between I and thou. Desire itself is transformed as it plunges out of its dream into the appearance. Every means is an obstacle. Only when every means has collapsed does the meeting come about. If I face a human being as my thou and say the primary word I thou to him, he is not a thing among things and does not consist of things.
whole in himself, he is thou and fills the heavens. This does not mean that nothing exists except himself, but all else lives in his light.
Thank you. Only when every means has collapsed does the meeting come about. Maybe that's why Rav Chia and his wife never really meet in the end. Now, this is true of man-woman relations, but this is also true of human relations. It's true of our relationships with our friends and our families and our colleagues. That dire importance of never ever seeing an other as a means to an end, as a function that they fill for me. The importance of seeing the others of our lives in their own terms, in all of their fullness, in all of their beauty, as the thou that they are. Only then can we really have a relationship. Only then can we really have an encounter. Good night.
We wouldn't always have records.